Hello, fellow movie lovers, and welcome to Cult Fiction, a podcast where we examine Hollywood's redheaded stepchildren. As a redheaded stepchild myself, I'm Stephanie Johnson.
And I'm Andy Boyle, and today we are pulling back Hollywood's crypt to review Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
It's getting kind of hard to believe things are going to get better. I've been drowning too long to believe that the tide's going to turn.
A 2008 sex comedy.
That we both hated.
And here's the most I can give this movie, listeners, to not bury the lead. I watched the trailer for this, and I had never seen Forgetting Sarah Marshall. We watched the trailer. We watched the trailer for this after we finished recording our last episode, and I was ready to palpably hate this movie with every fiber of my being, to like say it is as bad as any top three bad movie, to say it is like Howard the Duck bad. And it's not. I don't think I liked it. In fact, I know I didn't like it, but it got a laugh or two out of me, so it exceeded expectations in that way.
And it's well made. Like, the script is good enough. The production value is good enough, despite the fact that most of the main cast is now terrible.
Yes.
There's some good acting there. Kristen Bell pulling it for what it's worth.
This conversation led into a really interesting longer conversation between the two of us, in which I tried to make the argument that Jason Segel is a terrible person and had to come to terms with, I don't think Jason Segel, as far as I know, is not actually a terrible person. He just did some stuff that from an outward perspective, I was like, wow, what an asshole. But if you actually listen to some interviews and hear his reasoning, you're like, oh, you just didn't want to be famous. And then you were.
He didn't want to be this level of famous. And then he was on How I Met Your Mother, which we determined before we started this podcast. This was at like season three of How I Met Your Mother, which is just when the show is getting like peak good.
Depending on how long it took to edit, this was filmed and shot either like after season one or maybe season two of How I Met Your Mother, which is another thing I've never watched, but like you have, so you tell me, was like right as the Jason Segel star was really starting to rise.
Oh yeah, and especially, so this is a whole other sub thing, but Jason Segel is really musical, and he actually, like, actually plays the piano, actually writes music. He is a capital M music dude. And so he wrote a lot of music for this movie. Wrote a lot of the music for How I Met Your Mother. Most soundtrack in How I Met Your Mother, he either wrote or advised on. There's a joke on How I Met Your Mother where he is one of three boys, and they have this whole thing about how they're Minnesota men and they like argue and wrestle in the living room. And if you listen to the lyrics, it's just Jason Segel going, "Murder! Welcome to the murder train." And it's completely preposterous, but that's the level of musical he is, where like on his show, he'll just release music because he's that level of gifted.
Okay. And, like, completely preposterous but charming despite all of that is kind of the vibe. I will say his character, Peter Brentner, in this movie is so cringy and, like, self-effacing to the point of being pathetic that it gets in the way of what we are supposed to then go is charming.
So in case you missed it, Forgetting Sarah Marshall is the story of fucking, what's his name?
Peter Brentner.
Of Peter Brentner getting broken up with. and dealing with his breakup. And that's pretty much it. He goes to Hawaii because his girlfriend, his now ex, had always talked about a specific and particular resort that she loved, decided to go there, see what all the fuss was about, and oh no, his ex is there too, and she happens to be there with her new boyfriend. What will happen? Good thing the receptionist is cute. The end. That's basically this movie.
That's basically this movie. The funny thing is that completely doesn't touch on the fact that three of the four characters that are leads in this film are varying levels of celebrity in the universe of the film. But also, it doesn't really matter. The fact that Peter is like a professional Hollywood sound, Foley artist, musician, composer guy.
Okay.
Different things.
He's a composer.
He's a composer.
He has nothing to do with Foley art.
Fair. I do apologize to all the great Foley artists out there.
You fucking should.
Peter Brenner is a professional Hollywood composer. Kristen Bell is a, like, TV sensation actress. Like a Heidi Klum level actress. A Mariska Hargitay on Law & Order SVU level actress.
She's basically herself in Veronica Mars.
Yes.
Yes. Which is what was happening also in her career while she did this movie.
And the new boyfriend, who is Aldous Snow, played by the fucking insufferable Russell Brand, is a, like, super mega sexy rock star.
He's male Taylor Swift.
Yeah, that's really, like, a very sexual, like, comedically, parodically sexual male Taylor Swift is the level of fame, for sure.
Where people, like, see him, recognize him in public, kind of fawn over him, forget that he has his own private life demand that he sing on stage when he is just a place existing.
Sure.
That level of fame.
Yeah. And that is, like, that becomes the fodder for a decent amount of jokes in the film, and certainly calls to a lot of the, like, specific experiences of Peter. But you don't really actually need any of them to be famous other than to, like, mildly justify how they're all at this, like, super nice Hawaiian resort.
So it's important to note that most of the script is about Siegel's breakup with Linda Cardellini. That makes everything make a little more sense.
It makes everything make a little more sense. Listeners, in case you're sitting there going, like, where the fuck do I know that name from? Live action Velma.
Live action Velma. Sleepwalk with Me, Dead Like Me. The show she's in with Christina Applegate. Also, she briefly is a bit character, a recurring bit character in New Girl. So you've seen her. She's one of those faces of, like, oh yeah, I know her.
For sure.
Just like Jason Segel then proceeded to become a, oh yeah, I know him kind of actor. After breaking up with Linda Cardellini, he then proceeded to, like, date normal people because he was tired of being the and to someone else's headline.
Sure.
It's important to note, however, that Linda Cardellini was not the person who dumped him while he was naked.
Yeah, okay.
Because that is a real thing. In this movie, we have a scene of Peter, when he breaks up with Kristen Bell's character, he is naked because he's walking around their apartment naked.
No, more than that, she calls him. Yes. She calls him and is like, hey, I'm coming home. We need to talk. And he completely tone-deafly thinks that this is like some sort of verbal foreplay and gets naked to then, like, be waiting there all sexy and naked and instead is broken up with.
So apparently that's autobiographical. Like,
which is horrifying.
That's actually a thing he thought. He got a serious call from a girlfriend and denies that it's Linda Cardellini. We do not know who it is. Sure. And I think a little bit that Jason Segel is a gentleman for never saying who it is.
Sure.
It very well could be Linda Cardellini, honestly, but like, whatever. The one thing they didn't include in the movie was that he proceeded to want to get dressed for this very serious conversation he had to have. And then he said in an interview later, and he was like, I couldn't pick the right clothes for getting broken up with. It took me 45 minutes to get dressed.
What do you wear to your breakup when you know it's going to be your breakup?
Peter.
Hey. Hi.
What are you doing here?
Came here to murder you.
Really? What are you doing here?
I mean, I feel like you skip trying to win the person back and just accept it and, like, come out in, like, gray sweats and a flannel. And just be like, well, I'm already going to be depressed. This is what I'm going to change into after you leave.
That's a very safe and, like, caring for yourself kind of answer. My instinct, perhaps a little toxically, was whatever shows off my, like, best features. So, like, something that shows my arms and, like, pants that make my butt look nice. Because I want to just be like, okay, just... So we're aware this is what is being lost in this transaction.
This is what you're giving up on.
Which I think a little bit is what Jason Segel was trying to, like, maybe get at. But very important to note, Jason Segel hangs full dong.
Oh, yeah. We see his entire dick, his ass. He has a birthmark on his thigh that we learned about from this movie.
It's a lot.
He's not a bad looking dude. His dick is nice. His ass is meh.
His ass is a very, like, oh, you white man. Like, you got a Hank Hill butt a little bit.
Yeah, he kind of does.
Yeah.
It's like a Y that ends in an M.
For sure. I guess I have to give it to him to have that level of, yeah, fuck it. This will be funny on set.
I mean, free advertising?
Free advertising, sure.
Like, everyone who went on a date with him after that movie, if they had seen that movie, they were like, oh, yeah, this is what I saw on screen. It's nice.
That sounds like a bit from a goddamn Judd Apatow movie. That Jason Segel writes. It is a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, you know?
What are we to make of the fact that Jason Segel hangs full dong while Mila Kunis uses a body double for the photograph of her character flashing the camera?
That sexism is alive and well?
I suppose so.
That it does nothing to Jason Segel, but the fact that if Mila Kunis had used her own body, it would have been like she would have never heard the end of that.
Yeah, that's a very fair take.
And the fact that that body double probably got paid bank to show off her tits.
The fact that body double probably didn't really get paid bank to show off her tits.
Oh, you're right. Oh, that's sad. Oh, indeed.
While we're on this, the thing I have to harp on. I said that Jason Segel, as far as I know, hasn't done anything, like, bad. I think I get bad vibes off of him mostly because of the stories that... Allison Hannigan gave during interviews where it was like, yeah, he wouldn't stop smoking and I made it clear I didn't want to kiss him. So he was like, okay, we won't kiss in the show. I think I was like, oh, okay, you're kind of a dick, but neither here nor there. What I have a bone to pick with Jason Segel, it is one thing to decide you're going to be naked in your film.
Sure.
It is an entirely different thing for the final moment of this movie to be a reversal of that moment in which Mila Kunis, who they had like the whole tragic, you lied to me, I don't like you, don't ever see me again, go grow as a person, I grew as a person, I came to your show. They have like the resolution moment, and she walks in on him naked. And again, it's supposed to be funny that he's totally naked, and she showing that she like is cooler than Sarah Marshall, I guess, makes out with him while fully naked. That is the context of the moment in the film. The context of the reality of that moment is that Jason Segel wrote a scene in which Mila Kunis has to make out with him while he is fully naked. And maybe that's not as gross as my initial take of it is. Maybe it's entirely professional and in the art of the comedy. Maybe Mila Kunis didn't give a shit or thought it was funny. And I think it's fucking gross that Jason Segel, forced by the means of writing it into the movie that he was the writer of, forced Mila Kunis into that situation.
Yeah. No, it's not good. There's a lot of the way... There's a lot of ways this movie didn't age well. We also, when you boil it right down, this movie is about a white man who comes to an island and the native people heal him of his heartbreak.
Of which there's only one actual native Hawaiian who like aids in that process. Everyone else are the non-native staff at the bar who like help give him life advice,
or our white surfing instructor played by the brilliant Paul Rudd.
Oh well, exactly, yes.
But yeah, no, you're right, there's only one native person, but there's still the metric of I go to Hawaii to get over my ex, and now that I've had conversations and I've befriended a native man, I know that I need to take care of myself.
For sure. This also, like, kind of jump... Maybe probably doesn't... This actually is a part of a Hollywood trend I've noticed. I don't know if it started it, but there is a real-life thing in which Hollywood actors are like, I want to go on a Hawaiian vacation, but I want to be able to write it off on my taxes. How do I get myself attached to a fucking movie in Hawaii that I'll film for a month, and then I'll spend another month in Hawaii because I'm already there, and that's how I get my vacation?
Snakes on a Plane.
The movie that I really, it like locked into my mind is a movie called Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates.
Yes.
Which has, I think, I want to say Andy Samberg and Aubrey Plaza, and I've never seen the movie, but the trailer makes a big deal about them being in Hawaii, and I was like, there's no they all just wanted to go to Hawaii.
So the premise, I have seen this movie, the premise of Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates is that they're a pair of brothers who can, like, never get their shit together.
Sure.
And their sister is getting married at a destination location in Hawaii.
Right.
But you're right. It could be she's getting married and we need to find wedding dates. Fine. But by nature of we have to get wedding dates and we spend an elongated amount of time with them, it could have been Palm Springs. It could have been we're going to go up to Yosemite. But they're in Hawaii.
It doesn't need to be Hawaii. You don't need to set the movie in Hawaii. You don't need to set this movie in Hawaii. But in both cases, and for so many other movies, if you do set it in Hawaii, then all of a sudden you and the crew are all in Hawaii. And oh no, you're taking a 2-week vacation at the end of this.
Oh, how terrible. How awful.
Exactly.
I would be surprised if this movie took 2 weeks to make.
Yeah, that's fair.
Especially with how many green screens they used.
A truly ridiculous amount of green screens.
Yeah.
Like, shots that are clearly inside of, like, hotel rooms, and they're sitting on the balcony. And I don't know quite what the process was, but I guess they only had, like, a day or two for all of the hotel scenes. So they shot as many, like, wide shots as possible, because there are so many close-ups of like Russell Brand or Kristen Bell looking over, and there's very clearly a green screen beach behind them when they're supposed to still be in their hotel room.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was eye-catching for sure. Dancing around this a little bit, Russell Brand and Mila Kunis and Jonah Hill.
Oh yeah, Jonah Hill is in this, and he's so hard to watch.
Jonah Hill, this is in his like starting up hate watch me era, and you bet your ass I hate watched every Jonah Hill scene. He drained what little joy and like interest I did have in this movie. Every time he walked on stage, it was just like a brick wall went up in my mind of like, I hate you and you suck in this.
Yeah. Like, I hate you as a person and your character sucks and you're not doing too great of a job at it. Or maybe you are. You're doing such a good job that it's cringy.
You're doing that thing you did in Superbad, but it doesn't work as well in this. And to be fair, it never actually worked. Everyone just convinced themselves it was funny when Superbad came out.
Because you know what? You don't want to be the guy sitting there watching BBC and saying, oh, I saw that guy. He was my waiter. And I totally dismissed him like everyone else does in his life.
But yeah, just to burst your bubble for anyone who is a fan of those three, Jonah Hill is a like weird edgelord, manipulative, mentally abusive piece of shit who threw a bunch of psychology terms at his ex-girlfriend in the middle of breaking up with her to try and like make himself seem more smart and sophisticated and above it all, and is just has clearly shown himself to be a real dick. Mila Kunis dove to the defense of Danny Masterson.
Famed rapist.
Famed rapist, yeah. Mm-hmm. Famed rapist Danny Masterson. Mila Kunis gave the judge a personal character reference to him that she did not have to give, and then gave that awful apology video with Ashton Kutcher from their pool house. Their clearly very nice pool house that they filmed in front of because it was the cheapest looking wall in their living complex. So fuck Mila Kunis. And then Russell Brand, I have never liked Russell Brand, but there was a period where you could just say Russell Brand was annoying, and we have moved past that because Russell Brand has moved into his full-on British nationalism, fascist. Oh, by the way, he also raped a shit ton of people, and that has come to light recently. Guest starring on the Alex Jones Show, fuckhead era. So the three of them make this movie harder to enjoy than it ever would have been in the first place.
Yep. But we have Jason Segel, who isn't a terrible person. Kristen Bell, who if she comes out as a terrible person, I will be sad.
Indeed.
And the ageless, the wonderful Paul Rudd.
The ageless Paul Rudd, the elven Jack McBrayer, doing like a really funny side character, clearly like terrified of the concept of having sex with his new wife on his honeymoon. Maybe gay, maybe just likes to get pegged and needs to admit it. Unclear.
It's basically Kenneth from 30 Rock. It's just not. And then we have Maria Thayer, who has not been more thirsty in any other role I've seen her in.
Oh, no. No, without a doubt. Like, doing the, like, fun Ellie Kemper sub in, like, just wants to have a good honeymoon and, like, have sex with her new husband of it all. Also, much to my joy, there are a couple of like, oh my god, it's that guy that show up in this. The only Native Hawaiian that has like any speaking lines that isn't a drug dealer is an actor by the name of Taylor Wiley, who has just done a bunch of different shit. He's in 51st Dates. He's in Hawaii Five-0. He's one of the people who, like, has made a living being a Hawaiian dude who shows up in like, media projects filmed in Hawaii. And then maybe more joyful to me and you personally, we had a Blink and You'll Miss It cameo from Kirk Fox, who is Billy Boy from Reservation Dogs. And listeners, if you have not watched Reservation Dogs, pause this podcast, go watch all of Reservation Dogs. Go watch all three seasons and fucking thank me on Twitter.
It's beautiful. That show lives nestled in a secret corner of my heart. It's so good.
That is maybe my favorite show to come out in the past, like, 3 years.
It's, honestly, it's Taika Waititi. It's like that show and the gay pirate show. And they're duking it out.
They're duking it out. Taika Waititi can have Our Flags Mean Death, because I place a lot of what I love on Reservation Dogs on Sterling Harjo.
Oh, yeah.
And I will now watch anything with Sterling Harjo.
Mm-hmm.
Neither here nor there. But those were, like, some truly, like, I got up in my seat, like, oh, wait, oh, holy shit, it's him moments.
Also, we have Bill Hader. Who carries this movie.
Who is the best part of this movie as Jason Segel's friend.
And brother.
Yes, that's right. Stepbrother.
Yes.
That's right. Also, very clearly only had, like, a weekend to film. You want to talk about eras? This is Bill Hader, like, firmly as a, like, working cast member in SNL who doesn't have time to take a couple of weeks off so that he can go be in a movie. So they have to film all of his shit, like, quickly.
This is prior to Trainwreck, where he, like, hadn't broken out yet as a romantic character.
For sure. This is so early in that Kristen Wiig is, like, an unmentioned cameo.
That's right. She's the yoga instructor. The very thirsty kind of cunty yoga instructor.
That's an interesting discussion because, like, at one point Peter is trying to just be at this resort where he realized his ex-girlfriend and her new beau are, and, like, clearly be miserable but is trying to do something. So he gets drunk and tries to do yoga. And she, like, very clearly doesn't want this drunk amateur, like, bringing his cocktail in and doing yoga. But also, she's a yoga instructor at a 4 or 5 star Hawaiian resort. That's going to be, like, you're going to have 3 of those in every session.
Well, and the reason I use the C word for her is that she repeatedly body shames him.
Oh, for sure.
And multiple times tells him, you're not advanced enough for this. You shouldn't even be trying this. Which, that's not how you do body work, my gal. That's... No.
It does create the objectively funny moment where he does a full headstand.
Yes.
Like, as somebody who's dabbled in yoga, I could not do that shit. And he very clearly, like, had done it a couple of times with Sarah Marshall and didn't have a whole lot of experience and did the thing.
And he was trying. He was doing his best.
Meanwhile, Kristen Wiig is thirsting over Russell Brand, who's... I have such a problem with everything about Russell Brand's character, except the last scene we see him in. But I don't like the, oh, he's just so, like, la-di-da, laissez-faire, sex rock god. He just does happen to be good at everything. But also he's an asshole. But also he's not an asshole. But also, like, what are we doing with this character?
You want a clear line of whether you hate him or not.
I think I want his character to be an asshole because his actor's an asshole.
I hear you. And I think his character is an asshole, objectively. But he's also, like, even Jason Segel's character, Peter, is like, no, he's cool. There's one moment where he's trying to have a talk with him, and he says something I can't remember. And Peter just goes, fuck, you're cool. And he's trying to hate him.
Sure.
Because his ex is with him now, having amazing, very loud sex.
That reminds me, that jogs my memory on something else I actually hated about this movie.
The very loud sex?
No. It was an A to G kind of situation. I propose that this movie, and I will go to the extension of Jason Segel in the era of writing this movie, is deeply misogynistic. This movie, whether taking Jason Segel out of it, this movie fucking hates women.
Oh yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah, we have our two female leads, Sarah Marshall, Kristen Bell, and Rachel, played by Mila Kunis, and Kristen Bell is presented as like this. Always wants something more, like. Wants whatever she's not getting in that moment between her safe but boring weird ex and her exciting, this is what an A-list actress is supposed to date, sex god, current boyfriend. And the movie very subtly, like, presents her as an objectively human character for maybe the first, like, half an hour. And then her and Jason Segel start, like, getting on each other's nerves and start, like, being openly antagonistic towards each other. And then her character just takes a fucking dive off a cliff and becomes immediately, like, whatever the plot needs.
Mm-hmm.
And jealous and possessive and toxically, like... Does the whole, oh my god, no, we should actually get back together because it just didn't work out with my current boyfriend and I'm reeling from that emotional decision. I'm going to suck your dick now. Which is the last time we see her character, is that scene where she tries to suck his dick and it doesn't work.
Oh my god.
And she gets upset.
Yeah, that is the last time we see her.
Except for the very ending where she is in a TV show commercial. That is the last time we see Sarah Marshall. And then, on the other hand, we have Mila Kunis as Rachel, who, again, is presented as, like, a perfectly normal human being at the start and, like, kind of takes some charm, pity on... the sad guy who's in a really awkward position, does like an amazing favor to somebody she doesn't know because she feels empathy for him, starts to hit it off with him. And then very subtly, very, I would use the word insidiously, we get these glimpses of this deeply toxic thrill seeker. Like, they make a whole big deal about how her character basically ran away to Hawaii
mm-hmm.
because she didn't like college. And there's, like, this subtext of the danger of moving out to Hawaii and dating a drug dealer. And
that's not why she moved to Hawaii, though. She moved to Hawaii for a guy. Which right. makes it worse. So she didn't move to Hawaii because she hated college.
Oh, fair. Yes. You're right.
She moved to Hawaii because she followed a guy. She was in Hawaii with him for maybe a month.
Mm.
And then now she lives in Hawaii and this is her entire life now and she can't picture her life either way. But then also if she sees her ex, she turns into like She-Hulk and decides to murder him and has to be held back.
Gets like... super territorial and aggressive at the drop of a hat. The thing that sticks out the most to me, the thing that locked into my mind that, oh, the movie hates her character, is the scene where she is having, like, this sweet moment with Peter and then, like, jumps off a cliff into the ocean and makes a huge deal about how he also needs to let go of his inhibitions and jump off this cliff and do this, she admits in context of the moment, super dangerous thing, and starts like demeaning him when he doesn't, to the point where he nearly dies.
Yeah, jumps off of a cliff when he very much shouldn't, has to be talked through how he needs to more properly jump off the cliff. And that's all because, LOL, she's distant and she has feelings and she's difficult.
And I, yeah, and those are our two female leads. And I cannot in good conscience say that any female character in this movie is presented in a entirely good light. So that took a lot of the joy out of it for me. What little joy there was to realize, oh, this is like you could write a paper on how troublingly misogynistic this film is.
You even have Bill Hader's romantic interest, who I think has a name, but it's so immemorable that I don't memble.
I only know this because I have the IMDb up in front of me, but Liz.
Okay, Liz. But the whole point of Liz's character is that she's obtuse and not fun to be around.
And, like, overbearing to her husband, Bill Hader, to where together they do that thing where, like, they are the pointedly on one team couple. Like, Bill Hader chooses to not have any opinions because he will just have the opinions that his wife has.
Yeah, and we're going to talk to my brother and we're going to make it all okay, such that we're basically his step-in parents.
Yeah.
Who are just cheering him on via Skype.
Where she keeps doing the thing where she is, like, off-camera but listening.
Yes.
Which isn't, like, bad, but is incredibly passive-aggressive in a weird way.
It's incredibly passive-aggressive, and it's incredibly, like you said, misogynist. This movie hates women.
Yeah.
She's very much the, like, aw, come on, mom character.
Yeah.
She's boring. She's going to take the fun out of everything. Don't invite Liz.
H her up. Make her the same actress who plays Kristen Wiig's mom in Bridesmaids. And all of a sudden, that character doing the exact same thing is actually funny.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Because if you actually make it the mom and the dad, then all of a sudden you get like an easy bit of comedy out of that.
So, for example, there's a whole bit about how Liz is bobbing in and out of the camera, and there's a joke about her giving an on-screen blowjob, and then she pulls away and has a pearl necklace.
Right.
With an older set of actors, that just becomes Meet the Fockers.
Yeah.
That just becomes Barbara Streisand and
Dustin Hoffman.
Is it Dustin Hoffman? I thought it was De Niro.
De Niro is the other parent. Speaking of movies I don't like.
Yeah, Meet the Fockers is fucking awful.
Indeed. Yeah, by the way, we've mentioned a couple times returning to Cult Fiction, Judd Apatow. And yet we haven't actually seen an actual Apatow. Because the other film we saw him in where he contributed was The Cable Guy. Which isn't that same level of comedy.
No. Also returning to Cult Fiction, The Motherfucking Time!
The Motherfucking Time!
In the background!
Because we get a drop of Morris Day, Jungle Love, and it was delightful to me. We have now heard that song on more episodes of Cult Fiction than we have seen most actors.
I think that's what makes it cult, Andy.
Is
a reference to the time. Is the time cult? Why, yes, it is.
The time is absolutely cult. When you are a band only because Prince liked you so much, he made sure you were a band and shared your brilliance with the world. Yeah, I'd say you're a cult band.
The circularity. It makes me so happy.
I'm glad. Also to that to say, though, is Forgetting Sarah Marshall itself cult?
I put a big, like,
So here's my thing.
Okay.
There is a specific kind of subgenre of comedy that is close to the Judd Apatow comedies. And again, this is produced by Judd Apatow. This falls into what I'm talking about. They were like sex comedies, but not teen sex comedies. I think that's the difference between this and like American Pie.
Sure.
But there's this, there's Get Him to the Greek. I think Superbad a little bit falls into that. There's this awful movie about two dudes taking a road trip that I can't remember the name of. Hot Tub Time Machine kind of falls into this. Adult sex comedies of the late aughts were a thing. And this very clearly falls into that genre. What I don't know is because I can identify it as from that genre enough to make it cult, or am I just picking out that this is a niche subgenre type of film?
You seem like a really nice person, and thank you. You're very pretty.
Oh, gosh, you're like way prettier.
No, you're like so pretty.
Really?
Okay, so let's go back to the definition of a cult movie. Does this movie have any kind of following?
I can't think so. I think Get Him to the Greek does, but Get Him to the Greek is a lot more about rock music and, like, the music industry.
Mm-hmm. The other movie I think of the same genre, time frame, and level is, like, Acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
Or Superbad.
Sure.
Or even Knocked Up.
Yeah, for sure. This is drinking in the same bar as all of those Judd Apatow comedies.
Yeah, except it's not at the bar where the main thing happens. It's over by the jukebox, except it can't even pick a song, and it ends up getting pushed away from the jukebox by people who actually have decision-making power.
Yes, agreed.
So it's just like some dude at a bar. I don't think this is cult.
I agree with you, and just to talk about it because we haven't, if this movie is cult, it's cult because of Jason Segel's obsession with puppets.
That's right.
Which is like a palpable thing. And also, real quick, do you want to get into your Oscar?
Yes, absolutely. My Oscar for this movie is Most Muppets. For a non-Henson production.
Which, until they film Avenue Q, I think has to be correct.
Well, okay, so I know Jason Segel is obsessed with the Muppets.
Sure.
Part of his whole being brought into the Muppet milieu is because of this movie. Because this movie made it known that he has an obsession with the Muppets. The whole Dracula puppet musical thing.
The finale, like, moment set piece of the show.
Which we haven't even talked about, but listeners, if you haven't seen the movie, Jason Segel's character, separate from playing set music on Sarah Marshall, and then when he's mad at Sarah Marshall because they just broke up, playing the Seinfeld riff, is that he's making a Muppet musical about Dracula, and it's very stupid, and then at the end of the movie he realizes, ha ha ho, it's a comedy, and he writes it when he comes back from Hawaii and really works on it and works on himself, the end.
Indeed.
But that's the whole reason that he was invited to be within the Muppet universe was because people saw this movie and they were like, oh, real talk, are you this obsessed with the Muppets? And Jason Segel was like, the Muppets? I love the Muppets. Let me tell you about how much I love the Muppets. Here is my weird Dracula musical. I love Muppets more than I love most things. Please let me be on the Muppet movie.
And then he was.
And then he was.
And it's probably the best Muppet thing since the original Muppet movie.
I would say it's the best Muppet thing since Muppets in Space.
Yes, big agree.
Because Muppets in Space, so good.
Okay, real quick.
Yeah. Oh, no. I'm here for this.
On three, say your favorite Muppet movie. One, two, three. Muppet Treasure Island. See, we did the thing.
It's okay. You're allowed to be wrong.
Fucking anything with Tim Curry in a major starring role.
It's fine. It's okay. It's not Muppets in Space. It's gone. Okay, so look at me. Look at who I am as a person.
Sure.
Look at all of my I don't belong trauma. And then look at a movie where Gonzo's whole thing is, am I an alien or do sandwiches talk to me? And tell me that wasn't going to be my favorite Muppet movie.
That's, you know, that's fair. Tell me this. What's your second favorite Muppet movie?
The one with Jason Segel.
Oh, okay. All right.
Well, we have to trash this
Join us for our diverging podcasts in which we argue our tier lists of the Muppet Cinematic Universe. That's a fucking bonus episode right there. Yes, Muppets. And Muppet Dracula is objectively wacky and delightful. I love how Bill Hader is in the performance of Dracula randomly.
He's the stepbrother and he's just trying his best.
He's the stepbrother to this guy and, like, Peter found an entire fucking troupe of actors to be in this with him, but then also his stepbrother, who we don't have any context on if he's an actor or not. It's very clear Bill Hader heard this idea in the writer's room and was like, I am gonna fucking, that is my Saturday night, guys. That is, ironically, I have to be somewhere else Saturday night, but like, that is my fucking Sunday night, we are filming that, and I have to be there.
I will call out, I will text Lorne and tell him, I'm sorry.
I'll get fucking Pete Davidson to sub for me. That entire digression aside, I would also like to give Forgetting Sarah Marshall an Oscar, because every film deserves at least two.
Even this one.
Well, this one is a classic backhanded Oscar. We've talked about it. I would like to give this the most unlikable cast in the year of our Lord 2023.
Fair enough. Hear, hear.
When three out of your top five actors are objectively awful human beings, like, what is this? A 1970s Western? That was a joke for three people.
Let's try and make our podcast likable for humans, please.
Fair enough. When three of your five top billed actors are objectively awful people, I'm sorry, that is just a bad movie. And we watched this, like, right at the peak of emotional resonance for just how awful Jonah Hill, Mila Kunis, and Russell Brand all are comparatively.
Yeah, like, weirdly, when they were all in the spotlight for being terrible people.
Yeah. Throw in the fact that you can make an argument that Jason Segel's kind of an asshole, and I argue the top-billed, most likable character in this movie is Jack McBrayer and Paul Rudd.
And Kristen Bell.
Male actor.
Oh.
Yeah, because Kristen Bell is, like, objectively just, like, the one leading figure in this film where it's like, I have no problems with you, Kristen Bell. You keep doing that DirecTV commercial or whatever the hell you're doing.
Oh, she's also doing a commercial for Hers, trying to get everybody on antidepressants, which, like, fair enough, Kristen, do the good Lord's work.
Fair enough. Indeed.
But yes, Jack McBrayer, so lovely in this movie. Is he gay? Is he just too Christian? Who's to say?
Who's to say? And who's to say where the real Jack McBrayer is? This movie made me realize I miss Jack McBrayer. He did Wreck-It Ralph and then, like, fucked off on his pile of money from 30 Rock.
Have you seen the whole bit about how he makes redneck tiramisu?
No.
Okay, listeners, it's lovely. Just Google Jack McBrayer redneck tiramisu. He talks about how his favorite desserts are completely not fancy and how he doesn't cook, but how he puts things together. Mm. And he's just a bless your heart level of a human. And I don't mean that passive aggressively, like, oh, he's so simple. I mean that, like, I'm glad that Jack McBrayer exists on this planet level of perfect.
Hear, hear.
Hear, hear, Jack McBrayer.
You know who else I'm glad exists on this planet?
Kevin Bacon.
Kevin Bacon.
My Kevin Bacon is bookended at both ends by KB.
Okay.
Because I, of course, started with Kristen Bell.
I think, without hearing it, I think I have to give you the point on this one.
No, I did it in two.
Okay, all right.
But wait, can you tell me a way I could do it in one?
Well, no, I also did it in two, but you did it with matching initials. So right off the top, I think I'm giving this one to you.
Oh my God, because I'm brilliant? Sure.
Yes, now what was Kristen Bell in?
She was in Zootopia.
Was she?
Mm-hmm. She was the bunny? The main bunny?
Is she?
Yes.
Oh. Okay, learn something new every day.
I'm pretty freaking sure. I mean, double check me on that.
No, that would be Jennifer Goodwin.
Okay, no, then... What? No, she's in it, though. Fuck you, Andy.
Ironically enough, you can do it using Zootopia. But I'm not going to tell you how.
In one, you mean?
Yes. Oh, fuck. No. In two.
Okay. Well, okay. No, she wasn't. Apparently, she wasn't the main bunny. She was someone who played Priscilla. But I feel like she could have been the main bunny. Anyway, she was in Zootopia with J.K. Simmons.
Okay.
And J.K. Simmons was in Patriot's Day with Kevin Bacon.
Okay. While we're giving off show recommendations, Invincible Season 2 just dropped, and if you want to be the most terrified of J.K. Simmons you've ever been since you saw the movie Whiplash, dear listener, watch Invincible. He's amazing at it. But okay, I'm still going to give you the point for that.
Okay.
But I was also able to do it in two. I used my least favorite actor in this movie, Jonah Hill.
Why?
Because I knew how to get to it using Jonah Hill.
Oh, okay.
Because he was in Moneyball with Brad Pitt, speaking of, like, fallen star human beings.
What did Brad Pitt do?
Was very misogynistic and awful with regards to Angelina Jolie and the custody of their children.
Oh, yeah. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Continue.
But they were in Moneyball together. Brad Pitt was also in the movie Sleepers with Kevin Bacon.
Ta-da!
Well, so in order to end this as expediently as possible, I think let's go ahead and move into our final thing we do every episode, which is put our hands into the Hollywood crypt and trust in it to pick out our next movie for us. It's basically a grab bag full of ghosts and nostalgia. Hey, cryptheads. I'm deciding that's what you're called. Future Andy here. So we had pulled David Cronenberg's Crash and were very excited about an erotic car crash movie. And then, for reasons that are unclear to this day, that movie is not available for streaming. And there seems to be somebody's cornering the rights for Cronenberg films. Who knows? In either case, we decided to go ahead and roll for a new movie, and the Hollywood Crypt picked out for us John Carpenter's The Fog. So that's what we're going to be watching on the next episode. And for Andy Boyle, I'm Stephanie Johnson.
Well, that's all for this edition of Cult Fiction. If you want to keep up, you can follow us on Twitter at Cult Fiction Cast. You can also follow, rate, and review us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll close the crypt for now.
Join us next time when we see just what a true master of horror can do with the kind of premise you might hear told around a campfire, and learn about a horrible May-December romance as we take in John Carpenter's The Fog. For Stephanie Johnson, I've been Andy Boyle.
Are you actually recording? Because yes. You've said that multiple times, that you've been ready to go, and then you're not ready to go. And I start my little thing, and you're like, okay, whenever you're ready. And then I say the thing, and you're like, oh, okay, let me actually record. And I'm like, cool. Let me do the whole thing.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay.